Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Welcome to episode 117. It's an absolute pleasure today to be joined by Nadia Owusu. A little bit about her. She's a Ghanaian and Armenian-American writer and urbanist. Her debut memoir, Aftershocks, was selected as a best book of 2021 by Time, Vogue, Esquire, The Guardian, NPR, and others. It was one of, and you may have heard of this gentleman, it was one of President Barack Obama's favorite books of the year, a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, and a 2021 Goodreads Choice Award nominee. In 2019, Nadia was a recipient of a Whiting Award. Her writing has appeared or is forthcoming in the New York Times, Orion, Granta, the Paris Review Daily, The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, The Literary Review, Slate, Bon Appetit, Travel and Leisure, and others. Nadia is a director of storytelling at Frontline Solutions, a Black-owned consulting firm that helps social change organizations to define goals, execute plans, and evaluate impact. She's a graduate of Pace University, BA, and Hunter College, MS. She earned her MFA in creative nonfiction at the Mountain View Low Residency Program, where she currently teaches, and she lives in Brooklyn. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So awesome to have you. I mean, I'm just haven't finished the book today, and just kind of, it's going to be with me for a long, long time. And obviously all those awards have told you that you did a heck of a job, and you sure did. And that's not everything about your writing. So I look forward to talking about your other works as well, but Aftershocks is going to be the main source, because just a work of art.
Thank you so much.
How did I do on the bio, which is from your website, so hopefully it's good, but anything you wanted to fill in, or did I mispronounce or anything?
Nope, it was all good.
Awesome. Maybe we won't spend as much time on the background today as usual, since your memoir is about, you know, your life, mostly from the beginning. But just, I guess, maybe more about the reading part of it, the literature part of it. You do write about it in Aftershocks at certain points. What were you into? Were you reading? What were you reading? I know that it was definitely a print-rich environment, with your father being, you know, such a intellectual, curious man and everything.
Yeah, so I actually don't remember not being able to read. I learned to read really young. I think I was 2 when I started reading. And so for as long as I can remember, books have been a big part of my life. You know, at first it was, of course, like the kind of basic children's fodder sort of look in here. No, not in here. So I did that for a little while. But I, you know, I do remember sort of encountering books that really meant a lot to me at a young age. I read, you know, Lord of the Flies and Animal Farm and The Catcher in the Rye of Mice and Men. I really loved Their Eyes Were Watching God. That was a really important shift for me, just encountering this really lovely, powerful story that centered a Black woman, a young Black woman's experience. My dad had a lot of African literature on the shelves, and so I was introduced early to Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe, a lot very young, and very, books were a big part of my life, I think, as well, because we moved around so much. You know, my father worked for the UN, and so often when we would arrive in another country, we would have sent our belongings ahead, and so we would arrive and the books would be there for me, but I wouldn't know anybody. So, you know, usually we would often arrive in the summer, and so, you know, before school started, and so, you know, I wouldn't really know anyone, and so I would spend a lot of time reading.
Right. I wonder, I mean, like you talk, obviously you live in so many different places. Things Fall Apart is very close to my heart. I've taught it for many years especially when I teach world literature. you know, it was such a seminal piece, obviously, because it was written in English, you know, by an African about Africa, you know, getting rid of all the Joseph Conrad and all that crap, all the horrible colonization, you know, colonial type of accounts. I wonder what kind of role it has in where you grew up in parts of Africa in those times. Was it kind of like seen as a relic of the past, or was it still like seen as an incredibly important piece?
Yeah, not at all a relic of the past. I think it's still very broadly read and embraced in Africa. I think because, you know, it is a book that's set in a particular time, but I think what's really important about that book and a lot of Achebe's work actually, which sort of like traces the history of Africa in some ways through the lens of like usually fictional African countries that are very closely
Sure.
related to his native Nigeria. But I think one of the really important things about Things Fall Apart is that it's a pre-colonial story, and like so you begin sort of before colonization, and often even the history of Africa is like Things Fall Apart engages with the beginning of colonization, but there's a strong sense of what existed before and what was
Right,
lost
right, right, right.
through what happened. And often when we learn about the history of Africa, because you know the West largely wrote the history books, even if you're studying the history of Africa in Africa, you know, you don't learn a lot about pre-colonial African history, and it's told from a very sort of like Western perspective, and so I think that that's why the book continues to mean so much to so many people.
Right. Thank you for that. When you moved into high school and college, what were you reading? I mean, you talked about Zora Neale Hurston's Eyes Were Watching God as being a seminal piece for you, a turning point. Did you read more of her work? You know, what were you reading in high school and college that really thrilled you?
I was introduced to Toni Morrison and James Baldwin fairly early because my father really loved those writers, and so they're two writers who remain very important to me. I also read J.M. Coetzee's Disgrace in
Okay.
high school, and that was a really important book for me. I think because you know, the story of apartheid was part of my life, you know, living in Africa and growing up with a Ghanaian father who had a very Pan-African worldview, and sort of it was important for him that I understood sort of the history and how colonization is ongoing. And you know, I was very young when apartheid ended, but I had memories of it, and so that book was meaningful to me. But I was reading really broadly. I read all sorts of things, and still do, kind of across a wide range.
Obviously, you know, you read so much, and a huge part of your growing up was living in so many different places, right? Born in Tanzania, right? Father's Ghanaian, stepmother is from Tanzania. Help me out here. England, Rome, Italy. Did you live in the States for a little bit in Massachusetts, or that was just
I did
visits?
not. My mother is Armenian American, and she's from Massachusetts. But I was raised by my father, but we would sometimes visit my mother for the summer in
Right.
Massachusetts. Yeah, so that's the connection
I mean, is it too simplistic of a view to talk, okay, you know, you were somebody who was always moving, always on the move, and that reading was a refuge, was a place that you knew was solid. I don't know. I don't know how deep you've gone into the psychology of it, or was it just like, man, I love good words.
So I think. There are many things. I think one of the things about reading for me was that it was a way to make sense of the world, and continues to be. Like I was able to connect with the experiences of other people who may have been sort of going through similar things, and sort of had insights into how to understand what I was going through. You know, I think I write in the book, for example, about Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye and how that helped me to understand colorism and racism in ways that were really profound and sort of visceral in many ways. So that's sort of one example of sort of turning to books to help me to contextualize and understand my own experience. And then I think part of it too is that it also brought a lot of comfort, you know, because we were moving around a lot, books became my friends in some ways, you know, like there were characters who became really important to me, and I love to kind of tap back into those books encounter them again. And so I think that that was also part of why I loved stories so much.
I wonder how you or your dad or both saw James Baldwin's work, you know, being that he was African, you were living in Africa with all these different roots. But I mean, was he part of that Pan-Africanism that your father was a proponent of? Did you see him as connected, or did you see it as like him having different experiences?
Well, there are so many things that connect Black people across the diaspora. And I think that's sort of why Pan-Africanism is so attractive to me, because there are many shared experiences, but then it's also important to kind of to note and acknowledge the differences. And so for me to learn about sort of, you know, the African-American experience at the time that I did, helped me to understand anti-Blackness from another way. Like, it is a global phenomenon, and it existed in Africa in the form of colonization, and it existed in the United States in the form of enslavement. And so, you know, connecting those histories, and also recognizing, you know, my father is from Ghana, and Ghana was one of the big slave ports. And so I was always taught that African Americans in many ways are my family and ancestors too. You know, in the Ashanti culture in Ghana, we have a strong sort of connection to our ancestors. And so, given that a lot of African American people, if they were able to trace their roots, and some now are, you know, through DNA testing, will find that they have roots in Ghana and in that region, that is a meaningful connection to me. And so, I think for all sorts of reasons, I'm very interested in Black experiences, whether it's in Africa, in the Caribbean, in the United States, both in the ways that they're deeply and profoundly intertwined, and in the kind of specificity of those experiences too in each place.
Thank you for that. Am I pronouncing correctly? Anansi? Anansi?
Anansi.
Right. I thought that was so interesting in Aftershocks about how, you just talk about, like you're just saying about with the diaspora, like where, you know, exists in different forms in, let's say, the Dominican Republic or the Caribbean, in Latin, other parts of Latin America, in Africa, and just how you trace it back to these stories that you would hear. And, you know, with your father being so proud. You write about, I think that it was he said it once. I mean, it was a common expression, but the expression Bush, right? I mean, is that for someone who doesn't know, is that incredibly insulting, or was it something you said was fairly common? But
yeah, it's a pretty common expression. And actually it probably has like a mix of different roots. So one thing that I know about the Ashanti culture is that the kind of legend of the origin of the Ashanti people is that we're a people who emerged from the forest, in that, you know, it was actually a collection of different clans that kind of became one tribe through the experience of trying to tame a very powerful forest in the region, and to kind of tame it into farmland, and that experience is actually what united the tribe. And so it could be that the expression of like being Bush is sort of a reflection of that past of living in the forest and wrestling with the forest. Also, it likely has colonial roots as well, you know, and so in that way is connected to anti-Blackness and racism that existed with colonization, and the sort of ways in which the British in Ghana sort of insisted that their traditions were the right traditions, and that what existed before was uncivilized and, you know, Bush. And so I think you could probably trace the use of that expression to many things. It's not usually seen as like terribly offensive. People throw it around fairly easily, but yeah, I was interested in the ways that it kind of connects to both of those histories.
I don't know if I'd say middle of the book, but kind of towards the middle. You do such an incredible job playing with time, and, you know, going back and forth, and, you know, anecdotes that demonstrate a larger point, connecting the, you know, the past to contemporary, you know, today, quote unquote. But And so one of them was where, one of your mini trips or one of your trips to Ghana, where your father really was like, hey, I'm going to show you what the country's all about, what our culture's all about, the stool house, which was so symbolic and so important. And you talk about like that double consciousness of, of where he was, am I pronouncing it right, correctly? Osei. That's his given name, his birth name, but he was also Charles. Right, and ideas of like the colonial mentality, and like you said, just if it's called Eurocentric, it just makes you think about that word so much, like where it is the center and just internalized racism, colonialism, all that. I'm talking way too much. I wonder what those that trip, where you kind of like were like, whoa, he's also Osei and Charles, and what you kind of saw with that double consciousness and what that kind of larger point that brings out.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. That trip was very meaningful to me for so many reasons. One is that, because of who I am, I was born in Tanzania, which is a country that neither of my parents had deep connections to, but I was born there because my father was stationed to work there at the time. He eventually married a Tanzanian, and so I did develop connections that place. But many of the places that we lived in, we were only there for a couple of years and then we would move on. And so I often felt like I didn't have like a home or a homeland or a place that I could belong to in a way that wasn't really complicated. So even, the places that my parents came from, my mother, it, being Armenian American, her family came from what is now Turkey and were refugees fleeing genocide to arrive in the United States. And, I knew about that story, but I didn't feel deeply connected to it because I wasn't raised by my mother and I didn't grow up with her traditions and culture. I don't speak Armenian, I don't speak Turkish. And similarly, although I was raised by my father and felt very close to him and his family in so many ways, there are also ways that I was always going to be on the outside. I don't speak Twi, and I didn't grow up in Ghana. And so there were certain things that I didn't have access to in terms of even, the places that made up my DNA. And so on that trip, even though some of the time I was quite reluctant about the to kind of engage in the history lessons, my father could be very insistent that everything was going to be a lesson. And I think as a child, like sometimes you sort of you
Like, oh,
push back
Dad,
against that.
right? Yeah.
But there are ways that it was meaningful to me at the same time. Just learning about sort of where my family came from and my family's connections to this land that they had lived in, forever. And to understand that I was connected to it too. And at the same time that this place had this other history, the history of colonization that sort of interrupted traditions and sought to sort of undermine a way of life that was a very collectivist way of life and that is still maintained, in many ways to this day. Like when I go to visit my grandmother, she lives in a house that's surrounded by houses in which other family members live in this kind of big extended family that are always in and out of people's houses. In Ghana, your siblings and your cousins are kind of the same thing. Aunties are seen as mothers. And so it's very sort of community oriented and these kind of big broad families are sort of the ways that people live. Colonization sort of sought to disrupt so much of that and to impose, other sets of values in so many ways. And so noticing the ways that colonization still existed, the sense of internalized inferiority, the ways in which kind of it can be quite absurd. I think in the book, I write about how the Ghanaian legal system, like they wear the white powdered wigs that they wear in the UK. And I remember seeing that and just thinking, that is so absurd. And especially because my father had taught me the history that, the Ashanti people had a very sophisticated legal system before colonization. And so, it was just seeing all of that kind of coexisting at once, like seeing Christianity and sort of old practices and the devotion to ancestors, the ways that those things have merged and continue to kind of mingle in people's lives, was really interesting to me and remains really interesting to me.
The personal stories you get, it's one thing to learn in history class about certain things. It's another to get, these personal stories. There's you end that part of it with, just kind of like bathing in the lake and just feeling a connection, feeling home, obviously the extended metaphor of the book is the aftershock, is the earthquake. And even things that I thought I knew fairly a fair amount about, for example, the Rwandan genocide, right? You make the point that, you talk about just now about disrupting African groups and African, basically, the Europeans coming in and throwing so much into turmoil. Even that was based on like an idea of like, correct, help me if I'm wrong, the Tutsis were seen as more European, the Hamitic and this whole thing there, that even that was an aftershock of colonialism. And I would have said, yes, I knew that, but the way that you wrote it out is like, oh, okay. You really, it makes it very specific.
I mean, it is, often we hear people say things like, in this country we hear a lot sort of like get over it in terms of slavery. And the same thing is often said about colonization, but the thing is it's not over, it's ongoing, like the ways that those aftershocks sort of exist in people's lives and can continue to impact the ways that people see one another and interact in the world. And kind of the example that you're talking about with Rwanda was actually it's actually it was a common practice with colonization where the colonizers would select a particular group of people and give them certain privileges that they wouldn't give others, and part of it was to stir internal division, in order to maintain control. And the ways in which that has continued to impact the wars that we see today, on the continent and the conflict.
Well, yeah, again, not being from Tanzania, but stepmom was from there and you lived there for a while too. You do an incredible job tracing the history, maybe some of the more recent history. And, like you said, those aftershocks are ongoing. I mean, the country's been independent for 70 years ish, right? And even, I remember reading it, I don't remember exactly where, it talks about like native groups in the United States that I think the term was like were Americanized into homophobia. And I think of this that line when I was reading about, it's like Tanzania, which prides itself on peace and peace and peace and has so many great things going on, but is also incredibly like evangelical Christian in many ways, right? And is incredibly repressive towards homosexuals. And again, that word that you throw in, just disrupting. This idea of like the converse being more passionate sometimes than the originals, right?
That's definitely part of it. And I think with a lot of the really terrible homophobia we're seeing now on the African continent, whether it's in Tanzania or in Nigeria or in Ghana as well, we're having sort of a reckoning with that, and some really amazing activists in across the continent who are sort of fighting against those oppressive laws that are just becoming even more oppressive. But the origins of those laws are colonial, in many cases. Like they were brought in by the colonial authority. And also there are ways, like more recently, that certain kinds of ways of thinking that are tied to sort of the evangelical movement in this country. For example, the ways in which in Uganda, I think I read about this, that the kind of the George W. Bush's PEPFAR, which was this pool of money that was supposed to go to countries to sort of that was sort of like a pool of aid money that was going to go to countries, but it had attached to it that you couldn't teach sex education in schools in ways that would sort of emphasize using condoms, and that it was abstinence only, and that was a requirement that came with the funds And so there are ways in which policy, and sort of the political environment here, in many ways continues to shape people's attitudes, in other parts of the world too.
Yeah, I mean that was so sad and moving. It's like you know the ABC, right? Remind me what the B stood for.
Abstinence, be faithful, and use
Yes.
condoms.
Right. And you know the numbers we're talking about HIV positive in the country, and the numbers were going so far down, the stats were there, it was objectively a success. And then you talk about because of the strings attached to the money, maybe the prime minister or president there, maybe trying to, curry favor with the evangelical, and the C was taken away. And it was just like you saw the success, you saw how well it could work, and because of these backwards policies, we one step forward, two steps back, right? Yeah. Speaking of step back, like that transition. The book, the book starts with the first earthquake, and it's a literal one in Armenia, 1988. I want to say 50,000 or so were killed. Is that maybe in Yerevan? I think the capital
So
was in a
the
smaller part.
earthquake destroyed a city called Spitak, but many other
Right.
kind of places were affected.
Right. And so that's how the book starts. Tell us about the day, and I know you've written about it. But I always appreciate you sharing something so personal, all the stories, and really appreciate being able to read about it and hear from you. But what was the literal earthquake, and what was the metaphorical one there?
Sure. So my mother left when I was two, and so I didn't really remember her being around. I was raised by my father, who was sort of the great hero of my life. As I said, he worked for a UN agency, so we moved around a lot. But when I was seven, and we were living in Rome, which is where the headquarters of the agency where he worked was, my mother showed up at our house. And she showed up on the same day that I learned about that catastrophic earthquake that destroyed a city in Armenia. And I heard about the earthquake on the radio. My father always listened to the BBC World Service in the morning. And I remember, Gorbachev, it was then Soviet Armenia. And so Gorbachev came onto the radio and was sort of asking the world for help. And I remember the kind of announcer talking about the possibility of aftershocks, and I asked my father what aftershocks were, and he said that they're the tremors that follow an earthquake, and they're sort of the earth's delayed reaction to stress. And then, that same day, my mother showed up after I hadn't seen her in many years, and she took my sister and I to lunch, and we walked around Piazza Navona. And then she dropped us back at home, and she was gone again. And I think because, I didn't remember her leaving the first time, I was too young. So this was the first time that I had actually sort of watched her walk away. And so that was sort of my own personal shaking, my metaphorical earthquake that arrived on the same day as the actual earthquake. So my earthquake being my mother, and then the connection of her being Armenian American. I think that those realities sort of got confused in my 7-year-old brain, and I sort of became kind of obsessed with earthquakes and the ways we think about and measure disaster.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you say so eloquently, as you write about so eloquently, it's like, okay, what is the actual foreshock, FORE? What is the actual earthquake? Which one's the aftershock? How long do the aftershocks last? If we're talking literally, and it happens th 3 days after the original one, does that count? And it obviously can be extended so much into your own life. In your mother's family, many of them escaped, many of them did not, from Turkey during the Armenian genocide. You write about just the brutality of going through the desert, and oh gosh, when talking about the babies that were crying and having to shut them up, because they would put others in danger. And I mean, just hell on earth, as war is, as genocide would be. And of course, your mother would be, I guess, two generations removed from that.
Well, so my mother's parents were both born in the United States, but my grandfather was born in the United States in the same year that they arrived here, and his siblings were born in what was then the Ottoman Empire. So
Sure.
he's sort of
Yeah.
straddling second and third
Right.
generation. Yeah.
Right. And just, you write about the studies have been done on Holocaust survivors, their descendants, and just how DNA can literally have, the traumas programmed into it. And that, makes so much sense in the book, where all of the situations that you talk about and all the aftershocks. I wonder if even since the events of the book, if you've learned more about your Armenian heritage or background.
Yeah, part of, I started writing parts of what became Aftershocks as kind of a private project. I was doing it largely for myself to kind of make sense of the events of my life, but also to come to more deeply understand the places and cultures that my family came from that I had long been so disconnected from in so many ways, and to like more deeply kind of narrate myself into those histories and into feeling like I belong to those histories in some ways. And so I was sort of doing that for many years just for myself before I even thought about it as a book. But part of that journey was I eventually kind of came to a place where I was ready to, after many years, over a decade of estrangement, sort of reconnect with my mother. And through that journey of sort of coming back into relationship with her and, hearing more about her life and her stories, I also spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and her extended family. And so I've been really lucky to as well as sort of the research that I was doing about Armenian people and about the genocide and the history, also get to sort of experience the culture, and to, become more deeply connected to that part of my roots and my family.
Well, I mean, your book, your stories are, reasons number 1 million and 1,000,001 why, we just can't ignore history. I mean, its tentacles just into today. I mean, for Turkey not to say that it's a genocide, for certain countries not to designate it as such, as you talked about for, on the African continent, with colonialism, and it's, still to this day, all the things that are felt, and it seems to be ludicrous, right? Not to study it, not to put today side by side with yesterday and really understand those connections. I guess, speaking of internalizing, did you internalize, and misogyny is not the right term, but like, I don't know, did you internalize maybe more of a, man, I'm looking for the right word, the fact that your mother, a woman versus a man, was the one who did not come back, right? Unfortunately, men have throughout, history have been much more like that. Did she get more hatred or dislike from you, from family, because she was a woman, maybe more than a man would have?
Maybe I do wrestle in the book. I think we all have internalized misogyny and patriarchy in the same way that we all internalize racism. Whoever we are and wherever we are, it's so those forces are so baked into all of our systems and our culture and the way that we engage with each other. Media, it's everywhere, and so there's no way that that we don't internalize those things. And so certainly for me, like part of writing the book was sort of realizing what biases I had internalized and kind of probing them and asking myself questions about them. And I think certainly I was much less interested in the interior lives of the women in my life, my mother and my stepmother. Now, granted, we had very difficult relationships. My mother wasn't around and it was very difficult. That doesn't take away from the fact that I was deeply hurt and profoundly
Sure.
hurt by the loss of her. But I had to ask myself, like, were there ways that I was being less forgiving toward her? And had I tried to sort of come to a place of empathy and understanding and sort of look at the facts of her life, in any kind of meaningful way? And if the answer was no, why not? And should I do that? And so that's sort of the that kind of practice of self-accountability, I think, is something that's really important to me in my work. And especially if I'm going to be writing about other people, that it's
Sure.
important to sort of take a look at myself and to ask myself sort of like where I might have failed others as well.
I no pressure, but I want a book, please, just about Aunt Harriet. Oh,
know, she's wonderful.
I love her.
Yeah.
I say that because for many reasons, but I mean, you talk about how she would tell you basically, I don't remember the exact words, but she would say kind of give your mom a break.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and Auntie Harriet, Auntie Harriet is my father's oldest sister. My father had three sisters. He has three. They're still with us, my wonderful aunties. But Auntie Harriet had a big hand in raising my sister Yasmin and me after my mother left. My father tried to do it on his own for a while and was sort of struggling because he had to travel so much for work, and he didn't want to leave us with nannies, a lot of the time. And so he sent us for a couple of years to live with my Auntie Harriet in England, where she was a nurse for many years with the NHS, and she raised us, as her own daughters, which is fairly normal in Ghanaian culture, because as I said, aunties are sort of mothers, but she's one of the kind of big role models in my life, and she would always sort of push me to kind of try to find a place of understanding and forgiveness. And that's sort of how she approaches the world too, with an enormous kind of open heart and a lot of kindness.
I talk about her as if she's a character. Like, what a great character. Obviously, she's a real person,
Yeah, she is.
right? So, I mean, these are real people. This is a memoir. This is, I mean, you're incredibly honest about yourself, about your own struggles, about your own life, about others' struggles, about others' triumphs. A memoir. I mean, is that, how hard was that? Was that something, I mean, did you fact check with a lot of people, or more so like, hey, can you read this first? Like, what is that like to really just open up about so many things?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that a memoir is still so the people on the page, myself included, of course, are like we are real people in so many ways, but you can never capture all of who
Sure.
anyone is on the page, right? And so they are kind of characters in a way, because as memoirists, I wrestle with this in terms of it being a moral question about writing about other people and writing about my own life and the ways that people will be interpreted, is that you are making art, and so you're choosing what to take out and what to leave in, and
Right.
taking
Omission or
liberties. And yeah, and so I would never say that the people you encounter in Aftershocks are, the people in my life. I tried to a kind of principle that I held was that if I'm writing about somebody, that I need to be writing toward love. And that is something that I came to sort of through the process of kind of working on this project on my own, where sometimes I would be starting from a place of anger and then realize that actually that doesn't fuel me in terms of my writing, and often it ends up being really bad writing if I write that way. And that doesn't, for me, like that doesn't mean that you sort of pretend that you weren't harmed by things that happened, or that you whitewash things or try to sweep them under the rug, but it does mean that you can't reduce anyone to kind of a single story, and that you have to hold the possibility of them changing and their own transformation, their own journey, as much as you do your own. That you have to still sort of hold all of those things. But in terms of like how I approached the writing about other people, I did, I was in conversation with a lot of the people who appear in the book, and did sort of talk to them a lot about, oh, I remember things this way, how do you remember things, and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, you had some horrific experiences, abuse, throughout that you wrote about. I wonder, was that a re-victimizing? Was it cathartic? Was it all of the above?
Some of those sections they were certainly difficult to write. I did not experience them as re-victimizing. I think maybe my experience is a little different from someone who set out to write a book. Because I was writing it for myself, I felt like there were things about those experiences that I had not looked at for in an honest way, and that therefore the fear was sort of hardening me. And I think sometimes, like, when you sort of confront things and sort of try to make meaning and make sense of them, and you're willing to scrutinize the most difficult things in your life in a really honest way, then you can kind of set yourself free from them. And that was sort of what I was working towards in those sections. So that doesn't mean that they were easy to write,
Sure.
but in some ways they were a way for me to kind of move into like new possibilities for myself in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I've read enough memoirs where, I mean, I couldn't tell you what part of the book it was, but it was kind of like, okay, how is this going to end in a, like, I could only see simplistic ways that it would end, and it didn't. Right? It was like, the different ways, the last few chapters, the way that you space them out, the titles are just so skillful. And it is real life, so it's not going to be a Disney happy ending. But perhaps some of the darkest parts of the book, if not the darkest, is the blue chair, right? The blue chair was a rocking chair. It was a literal thing, and it was a symbolic thing. And so I think more or less, right, you kind of fast forward from like maybe 17 to like 28 for the most part. There's not a lot in those years in between necessarily, right? And 28 is when is the blue chair, and you do the countdown of the 7 days. What did the blue chair represent? Why did you pick it up off the street, and kind of what happened with it?
Sure. So, the blue chair. So I was in a period of sort of deep depression and anxiety, and sort of really felt like I needed to, that my grief was sort of taking over me. I had never fully grieved. My father died when I was 13, and as I said, he was like my, single parent for a while, and just certainly like one of the most important people in the world to me. And I had already, for the most part, lost my mother when I was 2. We had a few visits with her when I was a child, but she wasn't much around. I didn't feel deeply connected to her as a parent. And of course, I had my father's family in so many ways, who I remain deeply close to and connected to. And I stayed with my stepmother for all sorts of reasons, but we had a very contentious relationship too. And all of those things I had not fully processed and sort of made sense of, and kind of tried to kind of plow on and just keep moving. And finally it sort of caught up with me. And so I was really in this moment of reckoning, and I was sort of walking around New York a lot, kind of aimlessly, because I couldn't stay still. And I saw this blue chair on the street, and it was a rocking chair, and we always had rocking chairs in my homes growing up. I used to sit in them with my father and sort of read books. And for whatever reason, I decided to pick up this chair and sort of take it back to my apartment, like kind of lugged it back in the rain. And that wasn't really like me either. I was not a person who picked things up off the street, and so it was sort of strange
Your
behavior.
roommate told you that, right?
So I kind of dragged it into my room, and it actually turned out that I had what I now sort of recognize both as a breakdown and a breakthrough, in that it was a period of my life where I allowed myself to fully feel my grief and to mourn, the people that I had loved and lost, and began to sort of make meaning of some of the things that I had avoided. But much of that sort of took place in the blue chair over the course of 7 days. And so the way that the book is constructed, those sort of 7 days are interspersed throughout the book, and work is kind of a scaffolding ho holding together some of the kind of recollections from my life, and sort of the chapters that sort of alternate between digging into the broader histories and contexts that sort of shaped me and my own lived experience.
So as of, I don't know, maybe this is the third or fourth episode I've recorded where I switched chairs, and I'm actually in a rocking chair right now.
Oh, cool.
I smile when I think of your father. I mean, I smile of, you know, of, I have a little daughter and a son, and just the idea of, you know, him writing at the same time as you were writing, right? The two of you together. And, you know, you just talk about how much reverence you had for him, and, you know, how intellectually curious he was. You guys has had some great inside jokes. And so the rocking chair was just so, so meaningful for the reader. I can't imagine, obviously, for yourself. I know the word is used on the Indian subcontinent, Middle East, I guess also in Ghanaian culture. Is it Baba, Baba? Where's the
Baba,
stress?
yeah. Yeah, so I don't think it's that common in Ghana, Baba, but because
Okay.
I was born in Tanzania, it is very common. It is the word for father in Tanzania in Swahili. And
Okay.
so I think that's why I called him that. Yeah.
But yeah, just the idea of, sounds like, I think it was a gift you gave him, and you said he's the best Baba ma slash Mama.
Yeah.
And he, right, got kind of misty in there, right? He get, all of a sudden his allergies flared up, it sounded like.
Yeah.
That was a beautiful scene. You know, towards the end, a lot of, like, I guess zooming out, so zooming out to the world, to society, and then zooming in on your personal situation. Thank goodness that Kwame is okay. You wrote about it, like a what if scenario, right? Where your half brother and him, you moved to New York, and, you know, he got, I mean, so did that, so he him getting brought into the police happened in that same way, or was the whole story made up about him going, I mean, I know he was actually at the police station, but.
Yeah, so my brother did get so this was during the height of Bloomberg's stop and frisk policy, which I think we will be for a long time sort of reckoning with the ways in which so many black and brown men in this city were traumatized by ongoing harassment. And you know, I didn't grow up here in the United States, and so a big part of my coming of age was coming to understand the racial arrangement in this country. And a large part of that was those early years when my younger brother moved here for college, and he lived on the Upper East Side and was constantly being stopped by the police, just walking into his own building where he lived, exiting his own car, asking for directions. He was constantly being stopped and frisked. And it really kind of had a really, I think, damaging effect on his sense of self. And you know, it's not just him. I've heard this from so many other people in my life, you know, the impact that those policies have on people, and like the idea that you actually don't belong in your own home. But so yeah, he did get arrested, and it was sort of for, you know, kind of making a
Murky
wrong
water.
turn or something of that nature. But the story that I created in my mind was sort of more along the lines of the stories that we see in the news every day. And the reason that I wanted to write about it that way is because that is the terror and that is the fear and that is the place that so many black people go to when they get a call from their loved ones that they've been arrested, that they might not make it out alive.
Yeah, that story hit home extremely hard. And on a craft basis, it was incredibly meaningful and powerful, for sure.
Thank you.
I mean, you could write a whole book just on the fact that you experienced 9/11 in a pretty close up way, right? Basically coming out of the subway right after what would have been the second plane hit.
I did, yeah. So I attended Pace University, which is kind of right by the World Trade Center, and I lived in Brooklyn, and so I was coming into class that day, and actually I took a different train than I normally take, and otherwise I wouldn't have come out of the subway so close to the
Yeah, that's
World Trade
right.
Center. I would have come out sort of on the other side of City Hall. But I walked out of the subway just as, and I looked, everyone was standing on the street, kind of staring up at the building, and I didn't know what was going on. You know, at that
Of
time,
course,
nobody really knew what was going on, and so nobody was stopping us from sort of leaving the subway or anything like that. And so, you know, I looked up just as the building started to collapse, and then, you know, sort of ran with the crowd. And you know, there's sort of news footage that I can kind of spot myself in from that day.
Well, I mean, so there's that, there's the personal struggles that everyone has. There is the loss of your beloved father. There's, the estrangement from your mother, and at times your stepmother, relationship issues, all these things. And like we said, that, that brought you to the blue chair. There's a lot about faith. Your father wasn't a religious man. He wasn't necessarily into organized religion, but you really reckon with, well, first of all, you were listening to Coltrane. Right, who was one of his favorites. And am I correct in saying that you felt like a lot of it was just bottled up in Coltrane, the improvisation of jazz, and was one of those things that allowed you to just, I mean, to go mad, like, if not in a positive way, then at least a neutral way, right?
It sort of gave me this sense of creation and freedom and madness and the ways in which all of those things can exist at once. And
Right.
my father was a big fan of jazz, and when I was younger, he would try to get me to listen to some of the more avant-garde stuff, and I was definitely not interested in it then. But I think returning to it at that time in my life, I think it was exactly what I needed, and kind of had a profound experience of realizing that kind of expression, that kind of expression, and being in a place where I felt like I was so bottled up and hadn't allowed myself not only to not express but also not to feel the things that the events of my life. And so that was a moment of sort of like allowing myself to kind of move with that music and to feel that kind of sense of freedom and madness.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing as nostalgic as the music of your parents, right? Oh man. So, the relationship with your stepmother, at times was strained to say the least, and at times was beautiful. You both threw some pretty angry words at each other, and she says that in one of your fights that your father had died of AIDS, not of cancer. And so in the end, you really talk about faith. Like, I mean, is it fair? You basically said that your father was like a man god. Yet he was the type of person who would have told you, and you used one of the anecdotes, he told you, like, hey, people make mistakes. We're not perfect. He never pretended to be, right? And so all these things, these contradictions where he, like Malala, oh, here's a connection. Malala, who gave you a great review, right?
Yes,
My
that was so
gosh.
lovely. I got to meet Malala,
Oh my
and she's
gosh.
sort of one of my heroes, for
Yeah.
so many reasons, but that was really
Right.
lovely.
But I always remember the quote from her father that they asked, they said, what did you do for her? And he said, basically, don't ask what I did, ask what I didn't do. I didn't clip her wings, right? And your father did that for you. But you also wrote about, he was the kind of the old-fashioned ideas of, the woman's place is doing this and that. We're all contradictory. We're all contradictions. And so you were really grappling with that in the blue chair, all these contradictions, and, this father who you loved and still love and will always love, but also seeing him as more of a human being, I guess, than a like an idol.
Which actually gave me sort of, I feel like I was able to get a deeper connection to him through sort of letting go of that idea of him and allowing myself to really remember him as he was,
Right.
which was a sort of lovely and very complicated, as you said, person, as we all are. And that kind of gave me an ability to sort of reconnect with my memories of him in a really truthful way, rather than sort of like holding him up as this deity on high, which he would have bristled at,
Sure.
if he understood that that's sort of how I was try what I was trying to make him into.
Well, yeah, I think the expression is never meet your heroes, but you met your hero, and you're all the better for it, right? Three-dimensional person. I got to figure it's probably been, what, 25, 30 years, but may he rest in peace. It was great to get to know him through the book for sure.
Thank you.
Beautiful, I guess, second to last chapter was called Libations. And it's almost like an acknowledgments page, right? I mean, very much about pouring out, drinking a little bit for so and so and telling the reader why, telling that person why, using the first person, I. What a beautiful way to thank, to give respect to apologize, to make amends if necessary. And then the last chapter is home, which obviously is a huge motif or theme throughout the book, where you lived in so many different places. And, you know, not to give away the end or anything like that, but just such an incredibly cool way to end the book. Like I said, through the libations, you get to know so many people. You get to see your perspective, you know, maybe years later, you know, since the book ended. I felt like that was you in 2020, right? Versus like kind of the action of the book, if you will, stopped, you know, whatever, 5, 6, 7 years ago, you know, for the most part. Where'd you come up with the idea for the libations chapter?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that drew me, I'm really interested in ceremony. I'm really interested in the ways that we have used ceremony throughout history, whether that's sort of to mourn our losses, to connect us to one another, to celebrate, to recognize our ancestors. You know, in the case of libation in Ghana, we pour libation to our ancestors before we drink or eat. And that was a ceremony that I felt, you know, thinking about my father as an ancestor and thinking about the place where he came from, that this was a way that I could kind of connect to that homeland and sort of like practice that tradition and that ceremony in my own life. And it felt like a way then to also sort of to acknowledge the people who are still in my life and who are meaningful to me and in all of their complexity, but to do that through ceremony so that it's not sort of, as you said, sort of like this neat bow that's like everything's tied up, but it's more sort of a moment of pause and recognition, which I think is often what ceremony is about.
Yes. I wonder if you've read Jean Guerrero's memoir. It's called Crux.
You know, I haven't, but I have it.
Read it.
Yeah, it's on my shelf.
I'm sure you have a million books to read.
It's been on my list.
Oh man, your memoir reminded me so much of that. I mean, you know, obviously each person is so different, but like she does a great job of weaving in like history, and she uses the motif of like kind of like rules of the Mayan religions.
Oh, cool.
You know, traditions, customs, her own personal story, like you do, you know, like scientific things and surveys and studies, like I talked about with like the Holocaust survivors and traumas. And, you know, again, it's not a neat, happy ending, but it's just, your book is a coming of age book, right? In so many ways. Also, if you want to read it just for incredible writing, boom. Okay. If you want to read your book just for, you know, for a coming of age, for a historical view into colonialism, you know, so many, it works on so many levels.
Awesome.
Congrats. And who else inspires you these days, whether they're memoirs or not? Who else are you really reading and just, you know, being thrilled by and inspired by?
Well, I can kind of look at the pile behind me. So, you know, I have Caleb Azuma Nelson's Open Water here. It's a novel. Right. It's a really beautiful.
He's British, novel. Correct?
Yeah, he's British Ghanaian. So we have
okay.
Two. Yeah, and that one is in my pile. Hanif Abdurraqib's A Little Devil in America. That's one that I'm reading now. I have At Night All Blood is Black by David Diop, which I think was won the International Booker, I think. But anyway, it's a really wonderful book.
Wow.
So I'm sort of reading all over the place.
That's so cool. Just in looking at what you've written, you know, outside of the book, I mean, incredible spectrum. Why I Started Wearing Head Wraps for the New York Times Magazine, for a wardrobe update, Book a Trip to Ghana from the Wall Street Journal, 10 top books about roots, The Guardian, The Secret Life of Disha Filya, who is going to be my guest in a month. I can't believe it.
Oh, wonderful.
I know, right?
She's so wonderful, yeah.
Oh my gosh. I didn't really know my mother, but I did know her pilaf from, you know, Bon Appetit. Dance Time Across the Diaspora, Paris Review Daily, Hiring a Chief Diversity Officer Won't Fix Your Racist Company Culture. What a great title from Catapult. We've only touched upon all the things that you write about and do. What are you drawn to now? What are some future projects? Are you going to write fiction? Are you continuing to write a lot of nonfiction? All of the above? What are you working on?
Yeah, kind of all of the above. I'm working on a novel at the moment. So that's my big project that I'm I'm very obsessed with right now. I'm very frustrated and obsessed with at the moment. But yeah, I'm still writing some essays and reviews and that sort of thing. And I have sort of maybe an inkling of an idea of another nonfiction project for who knows how many years from now. I don't know how long it's going to take me to write this novel, but that's something on my mind eventually. Yeah.
Wow. Again, I'm not the first to say it, but just, I mean, what a truly a work of art that Aftershocks is. I saw all the awards and I'm like, okay, I know I'm in for a treat, but way above and beyond my expectations. So,
Oh,
just
thank you.
thank you for sharing that with the world. I wonder what kind of feedback you've gotten. I mean, I know that your story, all the different stories have got to ring true for a lot of people. I wonder what's been some meaningful feedback.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you for all your thoughtful questions, and for your kind words. Yeah, it's been really lovely. You know, like I think this is my first book. I didn't really know what to expect. It's kind of a strange book in many ways, in that it is a memoir. It's also a cultural history, and you never know, you know, how people are going to encounter your work. And so it has been, I've been so grateful for the reception, and have really loved kind of getting to talk to a lot of readers, mostly virtually, because you know my book came out, it was a COVID book. But now I'm starting to sort of talk to people in person now and then. But it's been really nice to hear from people, you know, with from very different walks of life and very different places who have connected with different elements of the book. And I also kind of through the book have done a lot of events with Armenian organizations, and that has been really meaningful for me to be welcomed into that community and get to know that community and talk about my experience as a Black person who is Armenian as well, which have been really kind of interesting conversations. And I've done some events virtually, but in Ghana virtually, you know, and sort of book clubs in Ghana, and that has been really wonderful too, to
Oh
kind of
man.
connect with Ghanaian readers. And you know, the book is also coming out in translation in some
Oh wow.
places, so that'll be really fun too. There's an Italian translation in the works, and so I'll have to practice my very rusty Italian maybe at some point.
Como se chiama in italiano? El libro, no, no, ese book.
I'm not sure. No, non so ancora. Non so.
Okay. Está bien. We'll finish with we'll be blessed by a short excerpt that you're going to be reading. Before that, any social media contact? Where can we buy the book? Any favorite bookstores? And yeah, any social media or contact info for
Sure.
you?
So I am on social media. I'm on Instagram. It's Where's Nadia? And I'm on Twitter. It's at Nadia Wusu1. I am less active on social media these days just because I've been really kind of engaged with this novel.
Good for
But
you.
I'm there
Good for you.
sometimes. I'm there sometimes.
Any
And bookstores, yes. So some of my favorite bookstores are in Brooklyn, because that's where I live. But
There you go.
definitely check out Cafe Con Libros. That's a really wonderful bookstore. It's an intersectional feminist bookstore. And then also, The Word Is Change is a new bookstore in Bed-Stuy
Nice.
that people should know about.
Very cool. You're not going to be sued by Carmen Sandiego, are you, for your Instagram handle?
Well,
Okay. All
it's
right.
not where in the world, so
Ah, okay, cool.
I'm
You're good.
safe.
You're
Just
good.
where is
You're
Nadia?
good. Tell us if any context is necessary or feel free to get into the reading. We're blessed to be able to hear from you.
I don't think so, but I'm happy to dive into the reading.
Yeah, please.
So this is a short chapter, kind of in the middle of the book. It's called Failures of Language. I do not have my great-grandfather's worn but carefully pressed cotton handkerchief. My father's family aren't much for holding on to material things. I do not have my maternal great-grandmother's red hair or my paternal grandfather's coffee bean skin. What an unusual combination, people often say when I describe my parentage, Ghanaian, Armenian, and more than once, how did that even happen? I speak 3.5 languages that do not belong to me, that do not run through my veins. English, Italian, and French, decent Swahili. When my relatives and country people maneuver between English and their home languages, Twi, Armenian, and Turkish, I grip the ropes of the English words as firmly as my jittery hands will allow and loop them into knots. I watch for cocked eyebrows and pursed lips to translate the rest. The warm, round percussion of tree and the orderly harmony of Turkish, which, spoken by my family, is diluted with a splash of archaic Armenian and a heavy pour of Boston accent, are familiar but impenetrable. I can spot members of my two disparate tribes in a crowd, but I cannot address them except in basic greeting and pleasantry. Good morning, how are you? Welcome. In tree, I can also say, even the elephant can swat flies with its short tail, and any river loses its identity when entering the sea. My father, when his intention was to remind or chastise, was fond of proverbs and folk tales. The heroes of those tales were animals of the forest, spirits, and gods. I know them by name. My Ghanaian relatives are at times tickled by my inability to speak tree. At other times, they are affronted. How can you not speak your own language, they ask, not acknowledging that my learning it would have required them to teach me. Once, when I was in the market with an auntie, I cannot remember which one, a woman asked why no one had taught me to speak my father tongue. Nobody wants to hear her speaking tree in an American accent, the auntie replied. Since she replied in English, I can only assume she meant for me to understand. In tree, I cannot say, love me, accept me, I need you. At 13, I could not ask my father not to die. In Turkish, I know the words for eggplant, yogurt, and savory pastries. The stories of my mother's family are very much concerned with food. What was served, whose dish was tastiest, and delicious gossip, who messed up the baklava. As a child, when I visited them in Massachusetts, we talked about eggplant, losh kebab, and pilaf with little chopped up noodles in it. We planned for dinner as we washed lunch dishes. We ate to remember those who escaped genocide and nearly starved in the desert, to honor what they made possible for us. My grandmother taught me to roll rice and lamb into grape leaves. My mother read to me from 1001 Nights. Ali Baba said, open sesame, and discovered a stolen treasure. A genie emerged from a lamp to do Aladdin's bidding. Scheherazade told tales to a king to delay her own execution. Another one, I said to my mother after each story. Tell me another one. I do not know the Turkish word for stay. At 7, I couldn't say, Mama, come back. In Armenian, the language largely lost to my mother's family generations ago at the hands of the Ottoman Empire, the only word I know is the word for underwear, vardig. This knowledge I cannot explain. When I encounter strangers from my tribes, they are startled by my attempts to communicate. They do not recognize me as one of their own. They laugh, charmed and perhaps a little disturbed by the discrepancy between appearance and sound. When I explain myself, they think me a curious hybrid. They speak to me, always, in English. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. If you're watching at home, you can see all the bookmarks and the way that I've marked up the book. And that was one of the excerpts for sure that I'd highlighted and bookmarked. Sometimes I'll say, you know, I recommend one that you would read. And I was like, I'll have her pick because there's too many good ones.
Thank you.
Too many good ones.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure. And I wish you great luck in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
An absolute pleasure today to speak to Nadia Owusu. Continue good luck to her with her writing. So looking forward to continuing to follow her career. Thank you everyone for listening to episode 117 with Nadia. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and please leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for it by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Although those latter two, we don't necessarily need to patronize anymore, do we? Amazon and Spotify. Please follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will P-O-1. You can watch this and other episodes on YouTube. Watch and subscribe to the Chills at Will Podcast channel. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will podcast is Wind Down Instrumental, and the other song played on the episode was Hoops Instrumental by Matt Whitehour, and both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for episode 118 with SJ Sindhu, a Tamil diaspora author of 2 literary novels, 2 hybrid chapbooks, and a forthcoming graphic novel. Her first novel, Marriage of a Thousand Lies, won the Publishing Triangle Edmund White Award and was a Stonewall Honor Book and a finalist for a Lambda Literary Award. Her second novel, Blue Skin Gods, was published to high praise in November 2021 by Soho Press. A 2013 Lambda Literary Fellow, Sindhu teaches at the University of Toronto Scarborough. The episode will air on April 12th. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills like Nadia Owusu, whose work, like Aftershocks, gives you chills at will.